Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, you remember this?
I am going to issue our notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country.
Yeah, well, never mind, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, April the 12th. Good as always to have you here, everybody. That was President Trump in his fourth day in office, pulling the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the then 12, now 11-member Asia-Pacific trade deal negotiated by the Obama administration. This, what you're about to hear, is American hog farmer Brian Duncan talking to us last week on the 439th day of the Trump administration.
And when we see this attitude towards China and also tough talk on NAFTA, right, and we saw a withdrawal from TPP, which was going to be a very beneficial agreement for pork producers, I think that's all combined to a negative psychology that there's already casualties in this escalating trade fight.
Much like healthcare, it seems, global trade is proving to be a bit harder of a nut to crack than President Trump had thought it might be. In a meeting with farm state legislators and governors today, Mr. Trump said he has told his top economic and trade advisors that he wanted them to see about getting the United States back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not really a surprise. The president hinted at it in his speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos in January. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin flat out said it in an interview on this program a month or two ago. Negotiations on this start, TBD, I guess. Trade aside, the fundamentals of this economy are strong right now, and we are going to get some corporate fundamentals over the next couple of weeks. Earnings, to be specific. Big Wall Street banks, JPMorgan Chase and Citigroup among them, are expected to report strong profits tomorrow, which could give a hint about the rest of things. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth has that one.
My fellow New Yorker Hope Bowman says her 401k has been making her a little nervous lately.
Yeah, I called the investment specialist at Charles Schwab yesterday because I got myself into a panic about my allocations.
She's been nervous for the same reasons a lot of investors are nervous these days.
Geopolitical worries are probably the number one thing right now. You have problems with North Korea, Trump talking about a trade war with China, things going on with Syria.
Jim Sinegal of Morningstar says that stuff's not helping stocks. Enter the cavalry.
Citigroup, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo will all be reporting on how they've done in the first quarter.
That's Susan Schmidt of Westwood Holdings Group. She says all this volatility is kind of great for banks, which thrive on lots of action and trading activity. Add in the boost from last year's tax cuts and bank profits.
They should be pretty strong, and so we expect this to be a good pivot point where the market can go back, ignore the noise, and refocus on what's important.
Namely, the underlying fundamentals of low unemployment, strong economic growth, which are broadly good for other corporate earnings, too. So, Ms. Bowman, what might this do to your 401k?
I think that probably if their earnings reports are high, then the stock market will probably do well tomorrow.
Quite possibly. Because bank stocks make up such a large chunk of corporate earnings, rising bank stocks tend to lift all portfolios. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
The media conglomerate slash entertainment slash digital video story of this Thursday comes to us courtesy of the Walt Disney Company. For a while now, Disney has been saying it's going to embrace a new kind of business model, one in which it delivers its content directly to consumers, not via third parties. And that gets us to today and the Disney-owned ESPN, kicking off its streaming future with an app known as ESPN Plus. $5 a month gets you sports fans out there a whole slew of live sports, including some college games, pro golf, and some Grand Slam tennis. But as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports, there is one big drawback, and it is completely intentional.
25-year-old Billy Naden is a diehard sports fan from Dallas, and when he first heard about the ESPN app, he thought, finally.
Oh, I was pumped. I was like, this is going to be awesome. I'll get rid of cable, and I'll just have streaming services.
Then he found out what the app offers, or what it doesn't. No Monday night football, no NBA games, no Sunday night baseball. For those, he'll still need cable.
The reason we won't see some of the larger games on this is very simply a rights issue.
Rebecca Lieb is an analyst with Kaleido Insights. She says ESPN Plus has the rights to offer some Major League Baseball and NHL hockey games. Also, boxing, cricket, rugby, less popular college games.
We know that those rabid fans are out there and they're going to tune in. Whether or not those games become water cooler conversation is another question.
With this app, ESPN is targeting the sports fanatic, where the college alumni who want to cheer on their old lacrosse team, says Doug Kreutz, a media analyst at Cowan & Company.
So this is a way to try to generate more monetization out of their super users to offset the lost monetization that's happening as people drop out of basic cable bundles.
In 2011, ESPN had more than 100 million household subscribers. That's since dropped to about 87 million. Kreutz says its parent company, Disney, is launching its own entertainment service next year.
Their learnings from this, the ESPN Plus, are going to be really critical to how the launch of that product goes.
As Disney, he says, keeps testing the appetite for streaming services. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
The promise of corporate profits and the prospects of a trade war fading are going to get us the happy music when we do the numbers. This next story could go right in that overlapping part of a Venn diagram of old-school fast food chains and fancy high-tech Silicon Valley food companies. White Castle, the burger chain best known probably in the Midwest, announced today it's going to start selling a slightly different kind of burger. Traditional White Castle sliders by all appearances, but made with the plant-based meat-like substance from Impossible Foods. It looks and tastes like ground beef. It even bleeds, kind of, but real meat it is not. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, White Castle CEO Lisa Ingram, the fourth generation of her family to run that company. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
There are probably no small number of people listening to this program without casting aspersions on your company who don't know what White Castle is.
Oh, that's awful.
I know. I apologize in advance. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so White Castle was founded in 1921 by my great grandfather, and we are the original slider. So when you hear the term slider, White Castle was the very first in 1921, and we have evolved over those years to be a company that continues to sell great 2x2-inch hamburgers, but also sells a wide variety of other products, including an amazing breakfast sandwich, a really savory grilled chicken, a wonderful veggie slider, and lots of other products that I could spend a lot of time talking about.
Let me ask you a question about innovation in the fast food space, specifically hamburgers and what it is that you guys do. Tell me about the Impossible Burger, how it came to pass. First of all, tell folks what it is. Remind folks what it is.
So the Impossible Slider is a plant-based product that looks and tastes very, very similar to beef. And we were really excited to be able to partner with Impossible Foods to be the first chain restaurant to launch this product. And we're really excited about being able to offer that to our customers to offer even more variety.
Did you all cook some up in the test kitchen downstairs? And who got the final say? It must have been you, right?
Actually, I have a very, very smart team, and they had the final say, but I certainly agreed with the direction of putting this into test. And it's in 140 stores now, but it soon could be across all of our restaurants,
which is 400-ish, right?
Yes, we have almost 400 locations throughout the Midwest and the East Coast.
When you were thinking about, I guess, expanding the menu, right? Because that's what it's doing, and it's no small thing for a restaurant company to do. Why did you say to yourselves, or what was the process by which you said, you know what, we need a plant-based option on this menu?
It really starts by listening to our customers, as we try to do with all of our innovations. So we have a lot of customers that have grown up on White Castle and that love White Castle and continue to love White Castle. We also have some customers that grew up on White Castle but have decided to be vegetarians. And so they would still come back to White Castle and they would ask if they could have what we called a cheese slider, where we would put a slice of cheese, some of the onions from our grill,
oh, yeah,
and serve that. That evolved into us saying, you know what, maybe we should offer a veggie slider. This was a natural evolution for us when we found out that Impossible Foods was creating a plant-based product that looked and tastes like beef, both for the people that like meat and for the people that are choosing to have a vegetarian diet.
When you look at McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and all the rest, do you think of them as competition, or are they just like an annoyance for you and you're steadfast in your, you know, we were here first and we're doing it right?
Well, you know, we really focus on our business model and what things make us unique. So we are we're privately held. We are company owned, which is different than many other players in the fast food industry. And we really think that's important. We want to be able to have the direct interaction with our customers and with our team members.
Do I have it right that everybody on the executive team at White Castle started making fries and burgers, basically?
not everybody, but one of the stats that I'm really proud of is we have 450 restaurant leadership positions. So all the way from a general manager that runs one store all the way up to the gentleman that reports directly to me, there's 450 of those positions. And 442 of those people in those positions started behind the counter and worked their way up. People come to White Castle and they think that they may only work for 3 months and they end up working for 3 years or maybe even 30 or 40 years.
How often do you eat at White Castle?
I probably eat there about once a week. I had a double cheeseburger yesterday, and that's always my favorite go-to.
Lisa Ingram, she's the CEO of White Castle. Lisa, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Guy. I appreciate it.
There is more from my conversation with Lisa Ingram talking about running White Castle. Also, why their sliders are only 2 inches by 2 inches. It's on the latest episode of our Corner Office podcast. If you're a fan of space or space travel or rockets or, and stay with me here, prize-incentivized innovation, you have probably heard of the XPRIZE, right? The best known was the Ansari XPRIZE, I'd guess. Get some of the credit for helping the commercial space industry get going. But there are other XPRIZEs out there, including this week the announcement of finalists for the Carbon XPRIZE, of which there will eventually be two winners of a $7.5 million grand prize to convert CO2, carbon dioxide, into something usable and economically worthwhile. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that story from the Sustainability Desk.
How's it going?
Gaurav Sant studies the materials of modern construction.
Things like cement, things like concrete, things like steel, things that are used to build stuff.
He's a civil engineer at UCLA, and he's always concerned with the usefulness of things. He questions the utility of solids, gases, his lab workers.
Are you doing anything useful?
Yay. Right now, he's leading a team that's made it to the final round in an XPRIZE. They've made the cut by remaking concrete. Concrete is ubiquitous. Since ancient times, it's been the literal foundation of our built world, and producing it is believed to create 5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. So with his team at UCLA, Sant has developed a new form of cement that, when exposed to carbon dioxide, actually captures the carbon and uses it to harden the concrete. And that's where it stays. If someday it gets used widely, it could play a big role in fighting climate change.
Globally, if you imagine that this becomes the standard of construction tomorrow, you're talking about maybe a billion and a half tons of CO2 sequestration annually.
The XPRIZE money would be a bonus if Sant's team wins, but his lab's already spent at least twice that much to develop this stuff. Finalist teams are all working on brand new processes that capture a lot of carbon and not just store it in the ground. Instead, they convert the pollution into valuable material like chemicals, plastics, fuels. And that's where the real money is. Marcus Extivore directs the competition at XPRIZE. He says saleability is key to winning.
We look at what is the global size of that market, how many tons per year of that stuff are bought and sold. The idea being that if a team can sell into a large market, then in principle they could get more CO2 into products and into the economy.
Some estimates put the value of the carbon recycling market at $1 trillion by 2030. Matt Lucas is with the Center for Carbon Removal.
The reason it's so big is because there's so many different products that you can turn carbon emissions into. And so when you can touch so many major commodities, you have a huge market potential.
He says right now there are more than 50 startups working on carbon recycling in North America, and that the attention the XPRIZE competition gets could drive a lot more. In the meantime, Sant's team is working towards the finish. That means scaling up their process by 10 times for a demonstration at a Wyoming coal power plant. The $7.5 million prize would be pretty sweet, but Sant says,
"You don't compete in these competitions for money. There's a higher purpose than money in it."
But the money would be a nice, concrete reward. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace. Coming up,
I look at where people are picked up in the vicinity of the New York Fed and the vicinity of one of the major banks, and they're dropped off very close together in space and time.
Information leakage is the phrase you're looking for here. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 1.2% today, 293 points, 24,483. The NASDAQ up 1%, call that 71 points, finished at 7140. The S&P 500 edged 0.8% higher, 21 points, 26.63. Rising fuel and labor costs aside, Delta Airlines squeezed out record revenue in the first quarter. So today, Delta shares lifted 2.9%. American Airlines ascended 2.5%. As we told you, analysts are expecting strong first quarter earnings reports from big banks. In advance of that, JPMorgan Chase notched up 2.4% today. Citigroup up 3.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.84%, and you're listening to Marketplace. We hear from listeners like you every day that Marketplace helps you understand the financial forces that affect your lives so you can make better decisions. Well, here's your chance to be part of our efforts to raise economic intelligence across this country. When you support Marketplace today, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. As a nonprofit news organization, we're counting on your help so that we can grow and keep getting better. Become a Marketplace investor today. Whatever amount is right for you, it goes twice as far right now. Give online at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A lot of the now everyday things in our lives, some of the whiz-bang stuff that it's getting harder to do without, they weren't actually, you know, new. At least the ideas. Self-driving cars, 3D printers, robots, and smartphones are just a couple of the things first hinted at in science fiction decades ago. That's one reason why companies are visiting Wetzlar, Germany, home to what is called the Fantastic Library, a public collection of fantasy and science fiction literature that attracts bookworms, yes, sure, but also companies looking for inspiration. Caitlin Raig reports.
The Fantastic Library in Wetzlar looks fairly ordinary from the outside. A few dragon decorations on its facade are the only clue that this small building houses something unusual.
So this is the oldest part of our collections. These are all pre-war science fiction adventure stories.
Claudia Seibel is a research assistant at the library. She winds through the maze of rooms, pointing out various subgenres of fantasy and sci-fi. Steampunk, fairy tales, and horror make up just a portion of the library's large collection. The library started in the late 80s as the brainchild of a former physics teacher, Thomas LeBlanc. He keeps it running mostly through donations and grants, and also through research projects, like one called Future Life.
The idea behind Future Life is that there are so many scenarios about what the future might look like in science fiction, we thought companies would be interested in hearing about them.
Sci-fi authors are well known for their predictive abilities. Star Trek writers imagined devices that performed like cell phones and Bluetooth headsets long before anyone could buy one. Companies that want to explore what other treasures can be found in science fiction pay from $3,500 to more than $100,000 to mine the expertise of LeBlanc and his team. The library offers lectures, brainstorming sessions, and staff will pour through thousands of books to assemble reports on specific questions.
We started with transport issues, will people drive cars or not, the basic stuff.
Now they work with urban planners, regional governments, even cosmetics firms. Seibel says companies are often less focused on product ideas and more curious about how consumers might react to new technology.
The basic thing about science fiction is that the writers think very deeply how the interaction between technology and people can take place. And they give storylines and sequences of actions and worlds. And that's what the firms are interested in.
That's what the vice president of Deutsche Telekom's design gallery was after. Stefan Kohn is responsible for the Future and Innovation Forum at the telecommunications company. Kohn worked with the library to create a booklet covering future trends.
Big topic for Deutsche Telekom is artificial intelligence.
Deutsche Telekom uses artificial intelligence in applications like Tinka, a virtual online assistant for customers in Austria. The goal is to streamline service. That doesn't stop some from worrying that artificial intelligence will make a lot of people obsolete.
And basically create a lot of job losses.
Or even go completely rogue, like HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Kohn and his team looked at other ways humans and machines might interact.
And that sparked an internal discussion where we analyzing how we as Deutsche Telekom are handling the topic of artificial intelligence and what is our digital responsibility.
The library's capacity is somewhat limited since staffers do research the old-fashioned way, without robots, just people reading books and writing down ideas. In Wetzlar, Germany, I'm Caitlin Raig for Marketplace.
A story now, well, it's an interview, really, about big data, lunch dates, Wall Street banks, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and how information is or might be being informally passed between Fed officials and bankers. David Andrew Finer is a PhD candidate in finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai. How are you? Thank you for having me here.
You bet. It's good to have you on. Do me a favor and tell me about, first of all, this data set that you plowed into. What is it? Where'd you get it? And all of that.
Yeah, I was trying to find inspiration for a second year paper, and I came across this treasure trove. It contains records on just about every yellow cab ride in New York City from 2009 until, for this paper, the end of 2014. It has details on pickup times, drop-off times, the GPS coordinates of the pickup and drop-off. It is a remarkable record of New Yorkers at work and at leisure.
As it were, yeah. So you the correlation you made is, or the study you made, the data you drew is big financial institutions and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, right? Tell me what you found.
I look at where people are picked up in the vicinity of the New York Fed and the vicinity of one of the major banks, and they're dropped off very close together in space and very close together in time. And I see increases around monetary policy meetings of rides to the New York Fed from the banks, and also lunchtime coincidental drop-offs where people from the New York Fed and from the major banks converge on some points in the city. And generally where I find the increase is in areas associated with dining and shopping, like Soho, like the Meatpacking District.
The issue here really is what you call information leakage between the Federal Reserve System and commercial banks, informal exchanges of information.
That's certainly what one might infer from what I'm seeing. Right. I can't observe information flow, but I provide evidence of an increase in opportunities for information right. to flow.
Now, we should say the New York Fed says this is ridiculous and it's outrageous to draw these conclusions. And also, there is some merit to bankers and regulators knowing what each other are talking about, right?
Yeah, the New York Fed's response, just about every empirical paper faces those sorts of criticisms, and I would love to hear specific feedback from the New York Fed on this. And yeah, I definitely agree that that there are benefits to communication, and I'm certainly not suggesting that people at the New York Fed should not communicate. The big question here is whether well-connected firms might be able to profit at the expense of others around these monetary policy meetings.
And it also is relevant that data leakage is a known problem with the Federal Reserve System. The head of the Richmond Fed had to resign over a data leakage problem. I mean, it's not like this doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting by mm-hmm. any means that there's intentional leakage of confidential information mm-hmm. or any sort of malfeasance. But every interaction, even a social one, entails the risk that commercial bankers might gain even accidental insights, something as simple as a look of discomfort if a question is raised that touches on confidential discussions.
So you said you did this for a project, right? A paper of some kind?
Exactly, yes.
What kind of grade did you get?
It went over quite well with faculty. certainly, it went over pretty well.
David Andrew Finer, he's a fourth-year PhD candidate at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. It was great being here.
Final note on the way out today, in which the big credit card companies save you a couple of seconds maybe at the register. As of tomorrow, American Express, MasterCard, and Discover are going to do away with their requirement that you sign for your purchases. Visa is supposed to do the same later this month. To be clear, the companies aren't going to require signatures anymore. Stores still can if they want. Tell you what, though, my 10-year-old is going to be bummed. She's got me down pat. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials up 1.2% today. NASDAQ up 1%. S&P 500, 0.8% to the upside. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.